Hello and welcome to this podcast focusing on dry eye disease. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Drs. Janelle Davison, Cecilia Ketting, and Corey Lappin discuss the latest in DED management, focusing on cold-sensitive approaches to tear regulation. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from Alcon Vision, Inc. First, Dr. Ketting reviews the definition of neuromodulation and its role in stimulating the lacrimal functional unit and basal tear production, with Dr. Lappin adding some insight.
So neuromodulation, neurostimulation, this is something that's being done throughout the body, right? We've got neuromodulation, modification of neurological function, including both neuronal and glial cell activity through delivery of a stimulus, such as electrical stimulation, magnetic stimulation, or chemical agents to specific neurological targets. Neurostimulation devices involve the application of neuromodulation through electrodes to the brain, spinal cord. So neurostimulation, while we do kind of overlap into eye care, it's not truly neurostimulation as it is within the rest of the body. So neuromodulation and stimulation throughout the body, right? When we're not talking about eyes, we're seeing that neurostimulation treatments within bladder dysfunction, chronic pain, dystonia, epilepsy, obsessive compulsive disorder, Parkinson's, Tourette's. So when we talk specifically about neuromodulation, what we're really looking at is the lacrimal functional unit and stimulation through different methods of the lacrimal functional unit with the trigeminal nerve. What it consists of, right, we've got our main and accessory lacrimal glands, we've got the meibomian glands, we've got the conjunctival goblet cells, which that's not always one I think about, but it is because, right, we think about the different layers of the tear and that's where they're coming from. But the other part that people don't think about are the epithelium, the eyelids, and the interconnecting innervation, right? That's the big one. And it is such an integral and important part of that unit because it's how it gets activated. And our ocular health, our cornea, really relies on the steady supply of our tears, right? We've got different types of tears. Corey, was it you that I was having the conversation with that there's three, but potentially four types of tears?
Yes. The fourth is the mysterious
tear. Is that, and that's the sleepy tear.
Yes.
Yeah, the sleepy tear. Because what is our, yeah. So we're not going to get into that tonight, but,
yes.
So the tears, right, they have more than 1,500 different types of protein and all of these nerve growth factors and all of these things that help with holding the epithelium able to heal the corneal nerves. It just creates this environment for functioning because it's an avascular tissue, right? We don't have blood supply getting to there. There's not all the nutrients. And this is what I kind of talk to my patients about, right? That's where the nutrients come from. And they're really important to allow everything to heal properly, to function, and keep this whole cycle going. And when we don't have that steady tear supply, or we try to put artificial tears on, artificial tears don't have all of these important components to maintain this homeostasis. So the idea behind neuromodulation is how do we activate that lacrimal functional unit to better increase tear volume of our natural basal tears that hold all of this in there?
I know, because we were talking about this, Cecilia, and the thing about that is with the three, possibly four types of tears, it's this concept that they are compositionally distinct. I mean, you know, because you would think a tear is a tear, but that's the fascinating thing about it.
They aren't, right? Because our reflex tears, we know, still have all the same components, but it's the ratio.
Yes. And it's the idea, well, the way I always think about it, it's like a basal tear's job is to nourish and protect.
Correct.
And emotion, and then your reflex tear is to flush. That's it. It's like, it's just scary. Emotional tears, the purpose is,
What is the purpose?
We don't know. So
basal tear production, as I've already mentioned, the activation of the trigeminal nerve, impulses to the brain, feedback that stimulates the lacrimal functional unit via either corneal nerves or via the nasal activation of the nerve, right? Because we know we've got two different nerve endings. One's on the front surface of the cornea, the most highly innervated part of our body, as well as we've actually got a branch of the trigeminal nerve inside the nose. Now, using either mechanical, electrical, or chemical stimulation of those nerves can trigger tear production, which is more of our true basal tear, right? I know that there's some concern with, okay, is it really a basal tear versus is it a reflex tear? And you know, we can actually look at the composition of these tiers and understand that, yes, it really is a basal tier, right? Direct simulation using either TrueTier, the OG, which was putting the electrical rod prod up your nose, and the other one. I had some patients who loved it.
I mean, yeah, I mean, someone like they like the cattle prod.
You know, nothing against it, but there you go. And then the iTier 100, which is actually a mechanical vibration. And then finally, the first chemical stimulation, which was varenicline, which we know is the nasal spray. So it's activating the trigeminal nerve, the lacrimal functional unit, through the nasal lacrimal branch of the trigeminal nerve in the nasal cavity. So corneal efferent neurons have a role in tear production. So when we talk about the cornea, because we're going to shift on to what's the new, right? What's coming, what we've had some experience, yes, we're really excited about, right, is the different, but we need to know about the different nerves and different types of neurons that are on and receptors that are on the cornea, right? So we've got three different, there's probably, we estimate there's actually a lot more than that, but the three different that we're most associated with or that we understand at this point, right? Or that we actually should care about. So cold thermoreceptors, which are about 15% of corneal sensory neurons, and they actually detect changes in tear film due to evaporation. So when you blink, right, the tears start to evaporate. So similar to like when we sweat, tear evaporates, we get cooling. And that cooling actually, when we're blinking, and we're talking about the ones on the cornea, not our armpits. So when it evaporates and it cools, it activates something called a TRPM8 receptor. And we'll talk about that in a second. The next one is a polymodal nociceptors. These are the ones we're probably the most aware of, or we think of when we think of corneal nerves, right? And these are activated by friction, heat, chemical irritants. These are going to produce a reflex tear. And then mechanonociceptors, these are going to respond to mechanical forces that are strong enough to damage. So these are things where you've got something in your eye, I've got an eyelash, things like that. When we talk about TRPM8, so this TRPM8, this cold sensing receptor found on nerve endings in the ophthalmic branch of the trigeminal nerve, they respond to that, what I was talking about, which is that slight cooling when we blink, and between the blink when the tears start to evaporate.
Next, Dr. Davison reviews available evidence for some commonly used topical DED treatments. Doctors Ketting and Lappin then add their perspectives on how they incorporate these therapies into their treatment plans.
But I tell my patients that dry is like a hamster wheel. You get into this vicious cycle of this condition where you have the instability of the tear film, which can be affected by so many things we know. But once patients get into this cycle of they have the instability of the tear film, they start to have changes in the osmolarity on the tear surface and this tear film. Then it gets to cell death and they get the inflammation. You just keep going and going. It's like the Energizer Bunny. And so we have all these therapies that are available and new things that are coming to the market. Some of our traditional therapies, where do you think they attempted to disrupt this dry eye cycle? And what are the new therapies going to do to prevent, or are they interrupting at a different point?
So, I mean, yes. I mean, you can see on here, anti-evaporative, looking at things that help with decreasing the evaporation rate, or actually decrease the meibomian gland dysfunction and improving that, right? We've got that area. We've definitely had immunomodulators, which are really important with controlling chronic inflammation. And then we're really moving into this neuromodulator that we started talking about and we'll continue to talk about. As far as increasing that basal tears, yeah, and all of those mediators onto the front surface. So I don't, again, because we keep talking about this, we understand it's multifactorial. It's not going to replace things. I don't personally think, other than probably an artificial tear, which is whatever. But
tell us how you really feel.
But I think that, you know, it's an and. I like to talk about treatments as and. I don't think they're ors. And I think that's the hardest part about dry eye is many times, and I've done this before, especially when I first started treating, I want a treatment. Because I think that a treatment is supposed to take care of it, right? Well, that's unfortunately not how this disease works.
That's what I kind of tell my patients. It's like, we're going to try to manage you as best as we can, get you to a level where things are kind of balanced. But this is kind of a roller coaster. We'll get to a point you'll be fine, and then we'll go back down, we'll go back up. But the goal is to try to restabilize that tear film at any point that you're having a flare up. And where I take from here is a lot of our traditional therapies seem to work. In the beginning, we just had really immunomodulators until of late. more downstream, right? So we're going to start looking, and I've seen in my clinic, because I got a lot of people that are referred to me, and they're like, God, they're like train wrecks. So I'm already thinking to myself, how do we get ahead of this? How do we get more preventive? How do we bring this more further up where we're managing patients before they really get into this vicious cycle of inflammation? And so that brings us to some therapies that we had in the past. And so when dry eye was on the market before we had topical FDA-approved medications, we would do what? We would throw topical corticosteroids on patients who had dry eye disease. It was we still do. And I still do not as much. It's exactly good for flares. Is even one that's FDA-approved for that?
Yes, a flare is great. Yeah, I also, you know, I think we might agree with this. I'd like to see what you guys think. I always feel like the two biggest mistakes in dry eye management when it comes to steroids are over-reliance and not using them when you need to.
I give them now as their rescue medication.
Yes. They are great for flares, not long-term management.
Exactly. Not long-term management, but also there was a comprehensive review that was done in 2022 by the Cochrane Review that looked at 22 different randomized controlled trials. And it showed that using anti-inflammatory drops topically for dry eye provided a small to moderate degree improvement in symptoms over just lubricants alone. And it also provided a small to moderate degree in symptom relief with cyclosporin A alone. In addition, using those chronically, we know that there's a potential may increase the IOP and cataract formation. So despite that, I will use corticosteroids. It's definitely not my chronic option for a patient. I love the one that is FDA approved for us to use it, and I prescribe it once I get patients to a certain maintenance level, just like you're talking about warm compresses, omega-3 supplementation. I'm going to prescribe this to say, hey, when you have those flares, if you come over, you know, you fly from Boston to Colorado and you're there for a week and fly back and now your eyes are flared up, you don't have to run and call me. You have that script that you can use to calm that flare down.
And I think it's good that we do still need steroids. I don't want anybody to shy away from them. I use them as loading. I use them for the flares you're talking about. I do have some patients where they're my Sjogren's or my people where we do need to use it more chronic. And then you can get into talking about preservative-free compounded versions of it, which I absolutely love.
In 2003... I think that's right. Cyclosporin came onto the market, and that's when everybody thought that was it. This is the end all
dry
be all.
Has been
we have
cured.
The silver bullet for dry eyes, and next thing, best against sliced bread. And so there's still a place for it. I think in some clinics, things are moving fast as far as innovation. And I think that makes it a little bit harder too for doctors who may not be versed to managing dry eye or entering the space, just trying to figure out what do I use on a regular basis. But this here is just kind of looking at a review of patients that were taking the cyclosporin for dry eye. There were 30 randomized clinical trials that were looked at over 4,000 patients to see patients taking cyclosporin A. How did it measure up when measuring, looking at their ocular discomfort, ocular surface, and looking at those tear film parameters, specifically corneal staining, Schirmer testing, and tear breakup time. But so this study particularly looked at patients taking cyclosporin over that time frame. How did it measure up? And it showed that sometimes with these patients that took cyclosporin A, there wasn't a big difference from the vehicle and artificial tears taking cyclosporin in reported trials. Cyclosporin was shown to increase non-serious adverse events, the burning. I'm a dry eye patient. I will say I was excited when it came out, but me as a big baby, I could not. I think I'm still scarred. I could not. And so we jokingly laugh, but tolerability is important. You know, if the patient can't tolerate it, if they're a big baby like me, then they're not going to be able to have the opportunity to see if this is going to be something that's beneficial for you. And then also lastly, looked at that topical cyclosporin A did increase goblet cell density on the conjunctiva, but that did not necessarily translate to improvement in symptoms as well as those tear film surface parameters that we looked at before. And so lifitegrast gave me that second option to be able to treat patients with dry eye with a topical therapy. With my still procedure that I had was punctal plugs. I think LipoFlow was around at that time. And so this is taking us a look at 6 retrospective clinical trials, looking at the evidence of the effectiveness of symptom improvement and signs with lifitegrast. One reason I was excited and moved towards lifitegrast as maybe my main go-to back then, because the data was showing that you were getting improvement in symptoms as early as day 14, yep, which we thought was rapid then.
Yes.
We're going to talk about it as we move with this innovation. There are things that are coming much, much sooner than day 14. But that was a kind of a game changer for me in my clinical practice, because one of the things that we had in the issues with cyclosporine A was it took a little bit of a time for patients to notice a symptom improvement. But I was just like most of my colleagues, I felt like we needed more. Even with those two options, I still wasn't necessarily able to reach all the needs of our patients. And so as we go back to that vicious cycle that we looked at a little bit earlier, if you notice, there was an option for evaporation. And so of late, there has been a drop that's come to the market, perfluorohexyloctane, for a dry eye disease that is a semi-fluorinated alkane. And what that just means, it has a segmented fluorocarbon and a hydrocarbon. It's preservative-free, that chemistry, preservative-free and water-free. And so what it is, in essence, does, it increases this lipid layer, increases the thickness of the lipid layer that creates this barrier in between the air surface and the tear film surface to prevent evaporation. And so this just kind of looked at some of the clinical trials that shows that patients who were using perfluorohexyloctane in the clinical trials were able to meet that primary endpoint at week 8 that included the improvement in total corneal fluorescein staining and eye dryness scores. And in the study, you were able to see some of this improvement as early as day 15 and continue out through day 57, which is important. We're working with these patients who are symptomatic, they're uncomfortable. Knowing these studies kind of helped me in clinic let the patient know, hey, I need you to continue for this time frame. This is when I anticipate you're going to start to feel some symptoms. This symptom relief, this is when I anticipate that I'm going to see some clinical changes. So that just gives them a kind of way of a pipeline, a blueprint of when what they need to do, expectations. And so this has been something that's really moved up in the option in my patients in my clinic. And so sometimes I use it as a first line, depending if the patient is completely MGD, does not have any inflammatory component. Like I said, a lot of my younger patients that are coming in, they spend a lot of time in front of the devices and things like that. So how are you guys using this in clinical practice?
So it definitely stabilizes the tear film. So I think it's an important distinction. We talked about this earlier today, that the perfluorohexyloctane does not improve meibomian gland function.
Oh, no, no, no.
Right? It mimics the meibom in the tear film. It anchors because of its being a semi-fluorinated, right? It's got a lipophilic bottom and an aerophilic top, right? Lipophilic, oil loving. So it anchors into the tear film and it helps kind of stabilize that top layer and decrease the evaporation. So it's really helpful in patients who have meibomian gland issues where they aren't getting the oil in there, and I'm able to stabilize and stabilize the front, the tear film, get them feeling a little bit better, but then also deal with the meibomian glands on the other end.
So you're doing a lot of combination therapy.
Yeah.
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 So with this, I tell patients, think of this as kind of like your little shield from the world.
It's just nice because it also represents a new mechanism of action.
Yeah.
That's what I like to say here is that, and we're kind of moving towards where dry treatment is more akin to glaucoma treatment now, where you have multiple medications. It goes back to things, multifactorial, multiple medications, multiple mechanisms of action, right?
Dr. Davison provides an overview of varenicline nasal spray.
We talked about this a little bit with neuromodulation. And so, this was really novel when this hit the space a couple years back, that we had something to treat dry eye disease that was not topical based. And so that was a little bit of a nuance for me in clinical practice, learning how to talk to patients about a nasal spray and how this is not like your nasal spray for allergies. Because all we want to do is we want to stimulate this parasympathetic pathway. You talked about the lacrimal functional unit. And so this particular medication stimulates the nicotinic receptors on the acetylcholine, and it makes that parasympathetic pathway to innervate the lacrimal functional unit via the trigeminal nerve. And so this just looked at the efficacy and safety of the medication in a two-arm study. And what it looked at is the proportion of patients that had an increase in Schirmer test scores, and that primary endpoint was met at week 4 compared to the vehicle from baseline. What I like to point out here is when we started to talk about this nasal spray, we're so used to talk about adverse events with burning and stinging upon putting a drop in. Now you have to have a different conversation with the patient when you prescribe varenicline. You're going to talk about the common adverse event is sneezing. And so if I have patients that
different.
Come to me, which is not necessarily a bad thing, when I have patients that come to me that I'm like the fifth doctor and I'm like, hey, do you want a drop that may have a little bit of a stinging, or you want to have a nasal spray that you may get a little bit of sneezing?
Finally, Dr. Lappin presents the mechanism of action and clinical trial data regarding the recently approved topical neuromodulating therapy, Acoltremon, with Dr. Ketting adding her thoughts.
So remember, there's three main types of receptors. Mechanoreceptors, touch the eye, you feel it. Thermal receptors, temperature, right? Polymodal, which says temperature, touch, and onions, noxious stimuli. That's the easiest way to think about it. Temperature, touch, and onions. So my favorite fact I'm going to share with all of you, because I want you to take away a fun trivia fact, because I love trivia. The cornea is the most densely innervated structure in the entire body. 7,000 nerve endings per square millimeter. That's incredible to me. And it's because we're sensing so many different forms of stimuli. And I mean, it's way more than what you just need for protection. And I know for me, I always wondered, how do we make the basal tear? Like you said, Cecilia, you know, you kind of talked about the evaporative cooling. When I learned about evaporative cooling, stimulating TRPM8, it was like the secrets of the universe were unraveled before me. I'm like, I have pierced beyond the veil and I know all. And it's just such an elegant solution. How do we make this basal tear? Because we're not worried about reflex tears. We're not worried about the emotional or the sleepy time tear, which sounds like a type of tea. And the more I think about sleepy time tears, sounds like a type of tea. We're talking about basal tear, the tear that protects and nourishes. So how do we make that when we're not thinking about it? That evaporative cooling. It's such an elegant solution that as the tear evaporates, it sends the signal back. And I love the phrase, neurons that wire together, fire together.
I love that.
So if you've ever heard that before, so basically you get the evaporation, you get that slight temperature reduction, 1 to 2 degree drop, the TRPM8 receptor gets stimulated, and then it sends a signal back to the brain and brainstem, and that's going to send a signal to the meibomian glands, the lacrimal glands, main and accessory. We all forget about Wolfram and Krauss, but I got you guys, and the goblet cells. It's that complete tear that we need to actually nourish the surface. Now, the polymodal receptors, though, I was thinking about them this morning. It was kind of chilly. I was tearing this morning. I was tearing when I was walking here. And do you know what I was thinking? This isn't a basal tear. This is a reflex tear, like not TRPM8. We have receptors that do noxious cold. The cold that I was tearing is not the TRPM8 receptor. So Acoltramon is a new medication that we got. And it's a first-in-class neuromodulator topical eye drop. So what this does is that leverages that TRPM8 receptor that we keep talking about right now. What it does is it is a highly selective agonist. So what this does is this binds that TRPM8 receptor the same way that cooling would, and it actually stimulates that same signal and you get all parts of that natural basal tear. But what about the studies? So the idea of this is we're getting increased tear production. So what they did is they did Schirmer strips. And like you said, nothing we're probably going to be doing in our clinic every day. But it's a good way to look, at least from a study perspective, to look at tear production. So the COMET 1 study was more of kind of just saying, okay, are we getting tear production here? And summarize this, yes, we did see increased tear production. SANDE, which is our symptoms, we saw that we got improvement. And we saw that that BID dosing works really well. What we really want to look at, though, are our COMET 2 and 3.
This is actually a really well-designed study.
Yes.
So I love that there's, and you're going to go into it, but I love that there's a 14-day vehicle run-in.
To explain that, Cecilia, because that's unusual.
Yeah. So the reason that we do a 14-day vehicle run-in is so that we can weed out super responders to the vehicle itself. We want to make sure that we aren't having people who in the study are just going to over-respond either in the vehicle arm or in the acoltramon arm and skew the data.
Yeah, and it also sets the stage. Everyone's on the same playing field. Like they've all had that. It's like priming the pump, I say, for a study, which is really great. So remember, day one was where they started. Day 14 was our big primary endpoint. And we looked all the way through day 90. So that's kind of the numbers to keep in mind here. Now, inclusion criteria, biggest thing to note, you're 30 years or older and you had dry eye. That's really what you need to take away from the criteria. Now, when you look at this here, this basically tells you it was consistent for demographic information, very similar patient population. That just is what you want to see.
White females over 60.
Oh, yeah. Our dry eye patients most of the time.
But it did add some diversity in here, yes. Which is what I like. It did. You know, if you start to go down, you see there's patients from other different backgrounds that are involved in this study. And that's one thing that jumped out at me when I saw this data, which I think is important. Dry eye has no particular person that it likes.
Yes.
I say it doesn't discriminate.
It loves all of us. It's an equal opportunist. Dry eye welcomes all comers. Let's make it simple. This looked at signs and symptoms. As far as signs, we're looking tear production. We also have a little extra exploratory endpoint of staining, which is great. Symptoms, we are looking at global SANDE. Global SANDE is a little different than your regular SANDE because it looks at both frequency and severity. So the biggest things to know is when we looked at tear production, we were looking at the proportion of patients who got from baseline an increase of 10. So 10 millimeters of wetting on that Schirmer strip from baseline. This was an unanesthetized Schirmer's test, which makes sense. It's unanesthetized, right? Because if you, Cecilia.
We're talking about corneal nerves. You put proparacaine on a corneal nerve. What does it do? It numbs it, right?
It goes to bed.
It goes to sleepy time, right? So then the nerves aren't working. And then how do you activate the lacrimal functional unit? Okay, you can't. So
you basically turned it off.
Right. So that does not make sense for this study.
Yeah. So, and then we had some other secondary endpoints, which were like day one, day 90, but day 14 was the primary and we had a lot of good exploratory endpoints.
Yeah.
So I actually put this in this order because I think these studies only make sense when you know where we started. So symptom wise, Sandy, when they looked at this, these patients were in the 70s. That is a moderate to severe dry patient symptomatically.
Correct. So for those of you who aren't familiar with Sandy or VAS, both of these are symptom scores. They start at 0 being my eyes feel amazing, or 100, I want them to fall out of my head.
Yes. And the other thing is too, when they looked at where were they starting as far as tear production, what's our normal production of tears when it comes to a Schirmer test?
10 millimeters or more.
So they were about half. So highly symptomatic in the 70s, about half the tear production we'd like to see. So this is what we saw. So COMET 2, COMET 3, remember, these are our main studies. Tear production, that's the easiest way to look at this. How many patients got to 10 or more millimeters of increased wetting of that Schirmer strip at day 14?
No, this is actually those who achieved, did you say increase or who got to 10 millimeters more?
The proportion who got the increase of 10 or more from baseline.
Perfect, yes. And we started at 6 something, right?
Yes,
is our average, right? So that means somebody got to, this is the people who got to 16 or more.
Up to 4 times more patients got that proportion. And then this is the pooled analysis. The biggest thing I want to show you here is look at day one. Here's the other thing. When I say day one, what they did is they put in a drop of Acoltramon and then they measured this after 3 minutes. So even though it says day one, this was measured at 3 minutes. So that's how quick we have this onset. The other question I know all three of us have gotten is, well, okay, are you going to burn out that nerve? Are you going to get tachyphylaxis? Day 90, it was still going, but that makes sense. This nerve, honestly, this whole process has gone on so many times. Like you've done this maybe hundreds of times since we started talking. So you wouldn't expect the nerve to really kind of taper off. The big thing I want you to see here is that this is rapid. This is so quick, within 3 minutes. So this is fast and it's sustained through day 90. So I think that's a big thing. All right, and then we also had staining. Here's the thing I love, and this we talked about lissamine earlier. We also looked at conjunctival staining. We often don't look at that. And why do you guys care about conjunctival staining?
I think it's important. I mean, no, do we do it on everybody, but I mean, looking, when we talk about the back to the lacrimal functional unit and the mucin, from the goblet cells, if you're seeing lissamine green staining on the conjunctiva, there's going to be a concern for inflammation and health of the goblet cells, right?
Yeah. So it's just, I love this, but the biggest thing is look at that delta, that difference between the vehicle and that, and it gets bigger over time. So that makes sense, right? You're starting to help that ocular surface recover. So again, you're also seeing that form of sign. So it's really impressive data. And then safety. So it only matters if a patient can use a drop, right? For this, 50% of patients had burning or stinging upon installation. And I will say this, if I did not know the mechanism of action for this drop, that would be concerning. When I saw 50% of patients had burning or stinging for this, and I knew the mechanism of action, I said, oh, makes sense.
It's stimulating a nerve, friend.
But here's the big thing. So 50% of patients felt it, which means 50% didn't. Of the 50% who felt it, 98% said it was mild, and 86% of them said it lasted a minute or less.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.